Welcome to the Reimagining Podcast with Theodore Richards. The Reimagining Podcast is a production of Wisdom Projects Incorporated, a 501c3 nonprofit organization which includes the Baltimore Wisdom Project and the Chicago Wisdom Project. Our shared mission is to reimagine education and reimagine the world by enhancing the lives of youth and adults with holistic education, intercultural understanding, and anti-oppressive, liberationist thought leadership. Chicago, where I was born and raised, is a city into which segregation and white supremacy are embedded in the very structure of its streets and buildings. I always thought that this time would be different for my children, but as events progress presently, we see that isn't true. I was born in Bronzeville, a home to many Black folks. Then years later, I would be uprooted. Uprooted to a neighborhood that carried the stench of segregation. A stench so disgusting that it would challenge my worldview at 10 years old. A child's mind so pure and free, suddenly interrupted by hate. A hate that was incomprehensible to a child who thought things had changed, or so I have been told. We left Bronzeville, the roots of my culture in Chicago, to Beverly, a neighborhood that didn't want my mother and barely wanted me. Her determination of having a home in this neighborhood outweighed my personal feelings of not belonging. She wasn't wrong for her desires of something different, something more that wasn't easily granted to us. It was my duty to persevere, thrive, and survive. I'm Ariane Richards. Welcome to Reimagining.
Tonika Lewis Johnson is a photographer, visual artist, and lifelong resident of Chicago's South Side neighborhood of Inglewood. In 2010, she helped co-found the Resident Association of Greater Inglewood, RAGE, whose mission is to mobilize people and resources to force positive change in Inglewood through solution-based approaches. She is also a lead co-founder of the Inglewood Arts Collective, established in 2017 to help artistically reframe the narrative of Inglewood. Within her artistic practice, Tonika often explores urban segregation and documents the nuance and richness of the Black community. As a trained photojournalist and teaching artist, she has been engaged in building an artistic legacy that gained citywide recognition in the last 3 years. She was featured in Chicago Magazine as a 2017 Chicagoan of the Year for her photography of Inglewood's everyday beauty, countering its pervasive media coverage of poverty and crime. Her Inglewood-based photography projects, From the Inside and Everyday Rituals, were exhibited at Rootwork Gallery in Pilsen, the Chicago Cultural Center, the Harold Washington Library Center, and at the Loyola University's Museum of Art. Her Folded Map project visually investigates the disparities among Chicago residents while bringing them together to have a conversation. It was also exhibited at LUMA in 2018. Since then, she has transformed this project into an advocacy and policy influencing tool that invites audiences to open a dialogue and question how we are all socially impacted by racial and institutional conditions that segregate the city. In 2019, she was named one of the Field Foundation's leaders for New Chicago, and most recently, she was appointed as a member of the Cultural Advisory Council of the Department of Cultural Affairs and Special Events by the Chicago City Council. Tonika, welcome to Reimagining.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
I want to start up with you, before we get into your specific projects and your work, I wanted to talk about the experiences that led up to that work. One of the things you've done is you've documented people's experiences in Chicago and their experiences with perceptions of Chicago. So I want to talk about that, but also kind of your own experiences, how you came into this work. And I'll say, you know, when I first arrived in Chicago as a student at the University of Chicago, I was told very clearly, implicitly and explicitly, don't go to certain places, don't cross certain streets, don't cross certain lines because it's not safe there. It wasn't always explicitly about race, but there were often like coded language about why it's not safe to go to certain places. That was one of my first impressions of being in the city of Chicago, and it's really stuck with me over the years. And Chicago is such a deeply segregated city, and that's one of the things you've often worked with. So I wanted to kind of start with how you came to experience Chicago as being a person from the South Side, from Inglewood, but also beginning to see Chicago in a kind of complex, nuanced way. And where did that come from for you?
Well, for me, it started in a couple of places. One, in elementary school and more specifically high school. This part that I'm going to share with you from my childhood was explored when Folded Map was interpreted as a theatrical production, and it went into the inspiration of Folded Map, which is my life. Folded Map is basically not only about Chicago, but it is the embodiment of my entire lived experience here. And so the theatrical production also included this part that I don't really share a lot about because it's so nuanced, but the time in my childhood when I was living in Inglewood that my mom decided to move to the north side in Uptown when I was 7 years old, and we lived there for about 3 years before we moved right back to the home that I grew up in Inglewood, because my grandmother was sick. And in my childhood, during those years, like 7 to 10 years old, I experienced Uptown, and Uptown was very diverse to me. I was living in a high-rise building. I had never lived in a high-rise building before, so that automatically gave me access to a whole bunch of different neighbors, not only just on my floor, but in the entire building. And then also I had access to the park that was right across the street that had a field house, that had a whole bunch of programs for youth. And that's how I met a lot of new friends from the North Side that really challenged what I had grown up knowing about the North Side as being just this place where only white people live. So when I moved there, when I was 7 years old and started meeting my new friends in Uptown, a lot of them were Black, biracial, some were white. A lot of them, majority of them, were first generation from immigrant families. And so during that time living in Uptown, I was also going back almost every weekend to the block that I grew up on in Inglewood. So that kind of initially started some unconscious observations, because my friends in Inglewood, when I would go back on the weekends, they would ask me about the North Side, like, oh, you're around all those white people. And I'm like, actually, I'm not. It's a whole bunch of kids that y'all would like too, I think. So that let me know just perceptions, and also that Chicago, definitely parts of Chicago weren't what people thought, including myself. And then when we moved back to Inglewood, to my home block, I realized just some of the amenities I missed on the North Side. You know, living in Uptown as a child, I had more freedom to go to not only the park and stay out a little later at that age, but also I would go and walk to the lake with my friends. And when we moved back to Inglewood, I wasn't able to do that. So those are things that I remember very clearly, just knowing how different my neighborhood was from Uptown. But then when I started high school, that my whole world just exploded open, because I went to Lane Tech High School, which is 15 miles north of Inglewood, and it is in a predominantly white neighborhood on Chicago's North Side. And the neighborhood was very different from Inglewood. And so that daily commute from high school, from home to high school every morning, is when I really started to have these observations that made me so curious. I was just like, oh my gosh, why does my neighborhood have so many vacant lots, so many fast food restaurants, so many storefront churches, so many abandoned buildings, and the neighborhood my high school isn't doesn't? And then once I got to school, that's when I was introduced to what I would consider what Chicago really is, this diverse city. And I met kids from all over Chicago, because Lane Tech is a selective enrollment school. And in the 90s, the racial demographic of the 4,000 student body of Lane Tech was curated in a way that it reflected the exact percentage, the racial demographic in Chicago. So there was equal percentage Black, white, Asian, Latino at Lane Tech. So there wasn't like a sense of a dominant culture in Lane Tech in the 90s, because it was equal percentage of us all. And so that just created an opportunity for me to build friendships and really get to know neighborhoods that I would not have known otherwise. But it was through my friendships that I got to learn about the, you know, Jamaican Bakery on Howard Street. I got to hang out in Wicker Park. I got to learn what the West Side of Chicago is. I got to even meet other weirdo artist kids from Inglewood that I did not meet in Inglewood. I had to go far away to Lane Tech to meet them. So it was really that entire high school experience that I was able to reflect on once I got older and remained interested in not only just my lived experience, but how segregation and being from Inglewood impacted my perspective of Chicago. And so I wanted to create a project that would explicitly show the difference that I had grown up knowing, that Chicago is segregated. And as a result, it isn't equal. It's separate and unequal. And Folded Map was...
You had to go to the north side to go to a better school, right? I mean, that was part of the whole...
Yeah,
to get like all those amenities you had in Uptown that you didn't have in Inglewood.
Exactly. And my life was pretty much deeply impacted by Chicago's segregation. And I had to grow up to realize that. Like, each time there was an effort my mother had to make to disrupt the segregation so that I could have access to things that weren't available in my neighborhood, my home neighborhood. Us moving to the north side for the first time, that was a disruption of the segregation. Me going to high school on the north side was a disruption of the segregation. So I was just able to see that our present day lived experiences of the city is really impacted by segregation much more than we think. And I wanted to create a project that revealed that in a humanistic way.
You said something to the effect that you met other weirdo artist kids from Inglewood, right? When you actually saw them in a different space and a different context and realized maybe that they weren't who you thought they were, right? Or that they had other aspects of their lives that wasn't as obvious, or you weren't aware that they were there. Did you ever feel like, was there a sense in which you also were able to know parts of yourself that you weren't aware of when you were in different spaces because there were fewer limitations placed on you when you entered into a new space?
Yeah, you know, being a kid who identified as, you know, loving arts, I had to be exposed to neighborhoods that had different amenities that for me to even learn other stuff that I liked. One example is cafes. If it weren't for, you know, my mom taking me to the north side and introducing me to cafes and me learning about the cafes that were around Lane Tech when I was in high school, I wouldn't have realized that that's an amenity that I would like to have in my own home neighborhood of Inglewood. So it definitely opened me up to learning more about myself, but also about other races and other cultures and their issues and struggles. If it weren't for my friendships with people who were first generation from immigrant families, I would not have known about the intimate struggles of acquiring citizenship. If it weren't for me knowing people and their mothers and parents and aunts and uncles who were literally struggling with that. So I was able to be educated in a more personal way about these larger systemic issues that I wouldn't have otherwise. So it definitely exposed me to a lot more than Inglewood, a lot more than Uptown. And it showed me that there's so many different lived experiences, not only in one neighborhood, but in the whole city. And you have to accept the fact that it's so many perspectives. And there is a thread throughout all of them, but yeah, it definitely, just that experience with diversity opened me up to learning so much more about myself.
Yeah, you know, we talked a little bit about kind of like Chicago as a whole and the difference between like the narrative. You hear a lot about Chicago in the news. If you don't live in Chicago, you have an impression of Chicago that is very different from what you've been saying, right? And you've talked about, you know, your experience kind of getting to know the city as a whole, right? A lot of folks in Chicago don't get to see the city as a whole growing up like you did, and how important that was for you. I think the other side of that too, though, and just to kind of like hone it down, like to get a little closer to the South Side and to Inglewood specifically, is even within Chicago, we have these, I sort of alluded to that a little bit when I was talking about, you know, when I first came to Chicago, how it was like, they were in this kind of university bubble and they were like, don't cross this street or that street. And there was always this sort of implied danger of the Black people lived on the other side of the track, so to speak. And, you know, just to really name it, you know, so I'd like you to talk a little bit about your community. And, you know, there is a narrative of what that community is like in Inglewood, but how you perceive that narrative to be, even if it's not entirely false, sometimes it's really like kind of one dimensional in the way that it's portrayed, you know. So talk a little about kind of how you perceive your neighborhood, Inglewood, as the public narrative versus the one that you know.
Yeah, going to high school, that's really when I got introduced to the perception people had about my home neighborhood that I honestly was completely unaware of before I turned 13. I just went to high school. People ask, oh, where you live? Where
you how dangerous you were, right? You didn't know.
Yeah, I was like, oh, okay. I didn't know. people would just be scared of me because I said where I lived. But that's when I started to hear, oh, wow, you from Inglewood? Wow. You know, and I was like, wow, that's really the opposite of what my life is in Inglewood. And so it was just, I learned how problematic that perception was and still is, because I would say back in the 90s, it was probably more justified of people viewing it as dangerous then than today, even though some people would find that hard to believe. But there was active gang violence in the late 80s and 90s as a result of a lot of things. And so I just was very aware that even though that was the dominant perception of Inglewood, that there were so many strong blocks in Inglewood. There were so many people who had similar lived experience as me where, yeah, you played outside every day. You didn't have any intimate encounters with gun violence. Like, people just did not think that kind of experience could be lived in Inglewood. And I was just like, okay, that means this neighborhood is way more complex than what people think. And also what I learned is that people didn't really understand like geography and space. I knew in high school that Greater Inglewood was one of the three largest neighborhoods in Chicago. And a lot of people didn't really understand that. So I say that to say, people didn't know that you could have hot spots in Greater Inglewood and the majority of the rest of the neighborhood is actually fine. Like, people just didn't understand that because they don't get the sheer size of the neighborhood. It's over 6 square miles. It's literally, it could be a little city. So a lot of my high school experience was combating what people projected onto me about my neighborhood. And if it wasn't about crime or them asking about gang violence, it was literally people being shocked that I was from Inglewood. And so I had to figure out that, oh, people are shocked that I'm from Inglewood because they already have an idea of who lives there. And that's when I kind of understood how these stereotypes and single perspectives of a neighborhood really does impact who people think live in these neighborhoods and how they value them and how they think they connect to them. Because people were constantly surprised that I was from Inglewood, and I was always confused by that. Like, I understood what they thought they meant, but that wasn't the case. Like, there's lots of Tonikas in Inglewood, and I just was amazed that they didn't think so.
You know, I do think that space is an issue. Often people don't realize how big and how not just Inglewood is, or how big Chicago is, or the South Side is, and just how, well, you know, you've been to my home, right? So you've seen, you know what my block looks like, and it's very nice, and it's on the South Side, and there's trees, and, you know, people walking their dog, and things like that. And I've had Uber drivers or taxi drivers, they'll pull up, and they'll say, they'll say something like, I've actually had people ask, are we still in Chicago?
Wow.
because it's just like, they can't imagine. And you know, the layout of the city and where I live, like you would really literally have to like drive into the lake to get out of the city from where I live. It's very far from being out of the city, but
exactly.
It doesn't meet their expectation for what they think the South Side should look like. Well, a lot of things are woven into that.
Yeah. Yeah. It shows that what they were told, because they haven't been there, so they don't know. So that means that someone told them that. And then it also shows that, you know, they believed it. So it's, you know, when I hear those comments at this age, you know, I already know they like that, if that person has done any work to get more informed or not, because
Yeah. And it's a, I mean, just to, again, to like name it and be really, you know, straightforward about it, it's, these are racialized perceptions, right? So as soon as you start to think in terms of like everything in terms of black and white, and in Chicago, it's really easy to do that. You know, when you have these lines between, and this, we get into your work too, and how Chicago is like the perfect city for your work in some ways, because you can see the grid of the city, right? And how it, mm-hmm. how it draws lines between. And there were a lot of the racist policies of the city were sort of like literally built into this city with the way mm-hmm. highways were constructed in certain areas. And so you can see these different lines between the way the city is laid out very clearly in this city, maybe a little more than in some other places. What I always feel when I'm encountering those kinds of obvious kind of stereotypes is that it's not necessarily that someone's coming at it with hatred necessarily, but it is that they tend to look at the other or the unknown in these very like monolithic, oversimplified ways, right? So they're not seeing like the depth and complexity and subjectivity of the people they encounter. They're thinking of them as like they can only really be one thing.
Exactly.
And so I want to segue into your work, because I think that's a lot of what your work does, right? I think it tells a story about people, and it opens up the possibility of a person's deeper subjectivity, which is much more complex than just sort of a statistic. I mean, your work is very different from, say, something that an academic might do in researching all this stuff, because it tells a story in a way that's a little different. So I guess maybe talk a little bit about what's the story that you tell with your work, and what's the kind of way that you're trying to like open up the possibility for kind of a little more depth and nuance in.
Yeah, no, I appreciate the question, because what comes to mind is over a decade ago, years ago, I remember when I was actually a couple decades ago, when I was in college and in photography classes, and I was oftentimes the only Black person, Black woman in a class. And it's very natural in that kind of education where you have classes where you get critiqued. And I knew then that my work was different from my classmates because of what I was documenting. I was doing street photography. I was documenting primarily the neighborhoods I lived and hung out in, which were neighborhoods of color. And I realized that, okay, for whatever reason, people are shocked by the normalcy of the neighborhood that I'm documenting. And so I was always bumping up against people being shocked by the normalcy and then wanting or projecting onto me to create different images because it was too normal. So yeah. I would have to defend my work and say, well, you're documenting the suburb that you are from, or this place you went to visit. That's no different than what I'm doing. Like, I shouldn't have to create work that fulfills some stereotype or perception of what you think of the neighborhood and what you're interested in as a result of that stereotype.
So did they get specific? Like, were they asking for like drug dealers? Like, what were they?
No, it was just always my work was not compelling, you know, like it was nuanced in that way, how they would express it to me. And I had to deal with that so much that I had to figure out what that was really saying. Like what is it you want me to produce? So I wanted to create work in direct opposition of what they were asking or subtly like requiring of me. And then a photographer friend of mine was like, no, don't let them influence the work you want to do. You don't have to be an answer to their misperceptions. Just continue to document your interests, your home, your neighborhood in a way that you want to. And all of the issues that people are projecting onto not only your neighborhood, but Black people in Chicago, your work will be a resource to combat that, but you don't have to explicitly do it. And so once the photographer told me that, it just allowed me, it gave me a certain artistic freedom to not think I have to look for positive images, you know what I'm saying? To combat, like, it gave me the artistic freedom to document what I want and document my community in the way that I saw it. And so once that happened, I just was able to see the value in documenting every kind of aspect of my neighborhood, Inglewood. And I wanted to solely focus on my neighborhood, primarily because I saw value in it. It's what I had immediate access to. I was like, I don't need to go out the country or go to another location and embed myself there to do a documentary work. Like, I'm here. I can do this. And so by me just doing that and like taking ownership of the freedom to document my neighborhood, I was able to create a body of or archive of images that clearly showed the diversity that exists in just a neighborhood that people view as just monolithic, dangerous, and criminals and victims. And so I realized that when you as an artist don't feel the pressure of responding to stereotypes, it allows you a freedom of doing work that ultimately becomes, that can be used as a response. And so that's what I focused on. I focused on documenting initially just photographing my neighborhoods in ways that I thought was beautiful. And that would later come to serve as evidence, if you will, visual evidence that one, this neighborhood hasn't been documented properly. And two, why is that? And so once I started to get some exposure for just my street photography of Inglewood, it became very clear to me that the larger issue was, how come we have not seen this neighborhood photographed this way? And so once I realized that that was the high level issue that kept coming out of the discussions of my photography, that's when I understood the impact of focusing on place, having the freedom to artistically document my neighborhood the way I want it, and what sharing it with the larger public, what it can have the impact of doing. So that's kind of how I balanced and figured out what my personal focus, my artistic focus is, to just let my creative freedom guide me as opposed to wanting to use my creativity explicitly to challenge what people think about my neighborhood and the people that live there.
The image I'm thinking of as you're talking is a series of images you did. It's like young people who are like dating, right? Like I've seen some photos like this, like just like, you know, teens or young adults who are dating and they're in love and they're holding hands and that kind of, those kind of images that I've seen you take. And it's like, what I love about those images is just how really ordinary they are in many ways, right? The background might look different or the people might look a little different, but you could take those same pictures in any neighborhood anywhere and it would be very similar, you know?
Exactly.
So I want to take a quick break here and we'll be back in a few minutes. Reimagining is a place for people who believe that the stories of the modern world no longer sustain us, bringing us to the brink of catastrophe, ecologically, economically, spiritually. Our troubles cannot be solved merely through technology or even politics. Rather, we need to reimagine what it means to be human. We seek new stories, new poetics, new ideas, and we put our ideas and stories into action. This work requires the wisdom of those at the margins and by those with the courage to imagine a new world. Welcome back. I'm talking to Tanika Johnson on Reimagining. And we've been talking about your work, Tony, through the Folded Map Project and how you've kind of been able to engage your own community and how that's been important to you to tell stories that are nuanced and complex. I want to talk about kind of the wisdom you possess and the advantage you have because you are from that community and you see that community not as an outsider. Mm-hmm. And talk about a recent episode that you had with the New York Times in which they did a story that, and you can kind of frame this how you see fit, but essentially they replicated some of your work and didn't give you credit and talk to you about it. And it was like from a very much from an outsider's perspective. And they ultimately issued an apology. Is that right?
New York Times did not issue an apology.
Oh, but they so it was a, but it was
photographer a photographer they commissioned.
Right. Okay. So talk a little bit about that. And I want to talk it from the viewpoint of what, not just in terms of like kind of like how they, the mistakes they made as an institution in terms of how they engaged the story, but also just what they missed in not seeing what you doing and really seeing what people who are in a community and from a community have to say about their own story.
Yeah. So even removing myself and my project from the story of New York Times, just how they covered Chicago segregation was a poor replication conceptually of my project, because I am very aware, because I researched, that my contribution to this conversation and issue of documenting segregation in Chicago was to show it visually. That was my specific contribution, and to show it visually through photographs and video and the people that you can visually compare. You don't have to just rely on reports. You don't have to only see the statistics. You can see it visually. And I was able to show that. I was able to show that this is how you can compare this well-reported on issue in Chicago visually, which is with two photographs using Chicago's grid system. So they lifted that concept and used it to do a photo essay on Chicago's life expectancy disparity between two neighborhoods, and one of them was Inglewood. And so just as a news story or a news photo essay, it was poor. It literally fed right into the same trope of how Inglewood is covered. So mm-hmm. that was problematic. The location that they chose to photograph in Inglewood were primarily on this one strip of street, Halsted, and specifically locations that are around a clinic for people who have heroin dependency, drug dependency. So me as an insider, I knew the exact locations that the photographer was photographing. And I knew that that was not even showing all of Inglewood. That was a very small one block, 1 to 3 block strip that also included elements that the larger public didn't know about. And so it wasn't a representation of Inglewood. It was just a representation of just 3 blocks in comparison to a poor representation of the comparison neighborhood, the richer comparison neighborhood. So just as a story, I felt that it was subpar. It didn't really offer any new information. It just kind of validated these larger misperceptions about the complexities of segregation in Chicago. So I was just disgusted by that alone. Then when I add the element of it being conceptually similar to my project, then that raised a whole bunch of other issues that we're all speaking to today, which is how systemic racism works. And for me, this was a great example of a snowball of several issues around race, one being ownership. The debate was, once I called out New York Times and the photographer saying that this looks very similar to my work, the issue of ownership, how larger media outlets, how larger institutions, how our country in regards to business has a history of stealing intellectual property of not just others, but people of color, Black people, whether it's artists, writers, whatever, and appropriating it to be their own and removing the original source. So to me, this was just a continuation of that horrible, longstanding history. There's so many examples to name of how the intellectual property or creativity of Black artists and entrepreneurs have been stolen, not only from inventors, but musicians, everything. And so I just felt like this was another example of that. And then also for the editor's note that they posted after they were called out, which said they didn't know about my work until after the publication of this photo essay. And then that was also problematic for me as a publication that is the pinnacle of journalism, for them to openly admit, oh yeah, we didn't know about this other project in the very location that our story is covering.
Right, yeah.
And the neighborhood and the issue. So it just showed a complete internal disregard to work that has been done in a specific location of a Black neighborhood by a Black female artist from that neighborhood still doing the work that has been recognized by her own city. So it was just disrespectful even in regional reporting. And so I just felt like it was my duty to call all of these issues out. And although a lot of photographers who saw this kind of debacle unfold on social media chose to focus on the copyright aspect of it. Like, no, you can't own a concept. You can't own, like, they didn't steal your project. They didn't see the larger issues involved, which is one, again, legal ownership of art and creativity. They were actually wrong. I do own the concept. I got it trademarked, but they wouldn't know that. And then two, the internal practices of New York Times does not reflect the proclamation they made to, you know, be committed to equity and reporting on race. And so it's just, I felt like a great conversation piece that can be added to where we're at in our current socio-political climate. It's just another great example of what we need to do to dismantle systemic racism and understand what it looks like. And a lot of people just didn't see it that way, but there were a lot of people who do. And that's the voice that I wanted to help amplify. Like, no, there are people who are in full agreement of what happened here and what it looks like and why it's a problem.
If folks are listening who aren't familiar with your work, I'll just add that you're not that obscure. Your work is very well known in Chicago, and I think nationally too. So it would have taken very little effort to uncover. I would question whether they really didn't know about your work or perhaps thought that it didn't matter. I find it hard to believe that they completely didn't know about it, but that's, you know.
Exactly. It's just like they have to choose which wrong they want to admit to. You could choose to say you didn't know about my work, which is what they did. Okay, so if you choose that, then we'll attack that. Why? Why didn't you know? You all are editors for the New York Times. How did you not know? And yes, once they see the long list of media coverage, it does include a couple of international stories. So it really looks poor that you didn't know. And then two, if you say you didn't know, not only how didn't you know, but now, once people look into my work and see the coverage it has, now it brings the question of, okay, did you really not know? Or did you know because her work has been covered and you just chose to disregard it and ignore it?
Yeah. So let's segue into that broader conversation that you were alluding to, talking about systemic racism. It's clear that this is kind of a moment in which, well, I mean, I think we can say two things at once. We can say it's a moment at which there is an opportunity for real change to happen. And at this, because there is more conversation publicly about some of these issues, and there seems to be certainly like a lot of people working hard to fight against the systemic racism. And so that's optimistic. And at the same time, there's also a deep resistance against any kind of change and any kind of, there's this deep pushback against anything that attempts to undermine white supremacy in this country. Mm-hmm. So we've seen that very clearly, you know, over the last 4 years for sure. So how do you view it? Like, what do you think that, I mean, I see an optimism in your work. You're bothering to at least try something. So I do see some optimism in your work. Do you think there's a way to kind of deeply rooted systemic racism? And a lot of your work, I think, speaks to not just the kind of systems of oppression that are there, but also the kind of culture of racism and the mm-hmm. deep attachment that America has to these views, right? Like, I mean, just to kind of like point to the elephant in the room, when people talk in these cliches and stereotypes about Inglewood, they're repeating the same tropes, the same racist ideas that have existed in this country for 400 years about Black people, not just about Inglewood, right? You know, Inglewood becomes a symbol, just like Donald Trump uses Chicago as a symbol for violence. Like, there's a code there for dangerous, scary Black people in Chicago. That's what he's talking about, you know?
Exactly.
Because we're almost out of time, but like, I'd like you to sort of say, like, what do you see? What do you see your contribution being moving forward? How do you see, a possibility for genuine change? And what do you think that would take?
Yeah, I do see a possibility for genuine change. And it's not anything that we have to start to create. It's there. We have connections across racial divides, class divide. We have those. Those exist. But the unfortunate nature, the insidious nature of the systemic aspect of racism is we don't get a chance to see or view those efforts in the same uplifted or covered in our news media the same way that we cover and talk about the divide and the conflict between these two perspectives. We really don't have nationwide examples, or not even just nationwide, but uplifting localized examples where people are doing work together, you know, and then not only people who are most impacted by these things doing work, but the allies and the relationships they have with others who actually care. I believe that it's just as much of us in this country, definitely in this world, who care than the ones that don't. And I just think it's a lot of propaganda to make it seem as though this country, the majority of this country, doesn't think in a more equitable, hopeful way. I personally believe that's propaganda. I personally believe that at this day and age, with a couple of generations under me, the millennials, the Gen Z, they have grown up together through social media and the access that the internet provides them, being able to connect to each other in a way that people my age and older have not. And so just by that alone, they have a deeper understanding of viewing each other as peers and equals than we had. And so I think that I want to continue to allow to use my work as being an example of that population of people, people who respect and value each other and want to learn more on how they can personally contribute to making our city, country, and world more equitable. Because I just think that people need to see that more, because it does exist. We're not operating in a vacuum. And as long as I can create work that helps people elevate that platform even more, I'm happy, because I know that there's people who care about each other across racial divides. There's friendships, there's families, we exist. And I just refuse for our reality and lived experience and relationships across all of these divides to be minimized and erased.
Tonika Johnson, thanks so much for your work. Thanks for reimagining with us.
Thank you.
The Reimagining Podcast with Theodore Richards is a production of Wisdom Projects Incorporated. Original music by Cosmos Ray. Sound engineering by Jim Qualley. Thank you for listening and for reimagining with us.